Tom Woods Show, episode 1528.
Prepare to set fire to the index card of allowable opinion. Your daily dose of liberty education starts here, the Tom Woods Show.
Folks, my Away carry-on is everything I look for in a suitcase. It's lightweight, strong. It's got a really smooth glide through the airport. It's got a built-in combination lock, a compression system for overpackers like me, and a laundry bag to boot. Get $20 off a suitcase when you go to awaytravel.com/woods and use promo code WOODS during checkout. Hi, everybody. Tom Woods here. It's been over 4 years since we last spoke to Richard Ebeling, who is a senior fellow of the American Institute for Economic Research and the BB&T Distinguished Professor of Ethics and Free Enterprise Leadership at the Citadel in Charleston, South Carolina. He spent 5 years as president of the Foundation for Economic Education, and we're talking about his new book, For a New Liberalism. And of course, liberalism meant in the European or 19th century sense, in which we're talking about freedom of trade and exchange and peace and the market economy and so on. And there are many interesting topics covered in here. We'll have time to get to only a few of them, but I did want to spend a little time with Richard today. Richard, welcome back.
It's a pleasure to be with you here today. Thanks for having me on.
All right, so let's talk about why a new liberalism. Is it that there's something wrong with the old liberalism, or is it that under new conditions, we need to maybe adjust the way we present it?
Well, I would argue that there's two reasons why we need a new liberalism. One is, at least and especially in the United States, the word liberalism has lost its original meaning, as I'm sure you're aware of. In the 19th century, liberalism meant individual liberty, free enterprise, private property, extremely limited government, impartial rule of law. But in the early part of the 20th century, and especially as a result of Franklin Roosevelt's New Deal days, in the United States, the word liberalism came to mean almost its opposite. If in the 19th century, liberalism meant a laissez-faire society in which individuals peacefully went about their interactions freely and voluntarily with their fellow citizens, following the New Deal, liberalism came to mean laissez-faire government. A government had the ability to freely do whatever it wanted with our lives and our wealth. And there's the other thing, Tom, that today liberalism is used in a pejorative term, particularly a phrase called neoliberalism, to put into one bottle, if you will, everything that the left, the progressives, the democratic socialists want to condemn. But by neoliberalism, they mean our existing economic system, which they define as laissez-faire or free market liberalism. And the fact is, we do not live in a free market liberal society. We live in a society of government intervention, regulation, redistribution, intervention. So liberalism is misunderstood in various ways. The term was hijacked in the early and middle decades of the 20th century. And the way it's currently used, it's condemned for holding everything responsible that the left dislikes. So we need to sort of take it out of both of these hands and redefine liberalism, refine it, extend it, make it better and more logically consistent with what the original liberals of the 19th century viewed as their ideal. And again, if I can just repeat, a spirit and a philosophy of individual liberty based upon the idea that individuals have certain inherent rights to their life, liberty, and honestly acquired property, that human relationships are to be based to the greatest extent humanly possible on voluntary association and freedom of exchange, what used to be referred to as the institutions of civil society, and an extremely limited government, constitutionally restrained, with a impartial rule of law, where the role of the state is to protect those narrowly defined individual liberties and not to violate them. And if we can restore that ideal and its understanding, then we have a chance to become the alternative to all of these other forms of statism and collectivism, which were destructive in the 20th century and are threatening to do so again in the 21st.
You situate the argument of your book by starting off with a few chapters on the American tradition and, well, it really classical liberalism in its history and then as practiced in the United States. So we've got some historical background. I'd like to focus on some economic topics with you. And before we jump into those, in case I have people listening who are unfamiliar with you, a lot of people who listen to me know who Bob Murphy is because he and I host a podcast together called Contra Krugman. And I'll just say, Bob says that when he had you as a professor at Hillsdale College, he says that he was absolutely blown away by how you could just walk into a classroom and off the top of your head, start writing things on the board and then just lecturing about these things without any notes. And he, you know, more or less came to the conclusion, I want to be that guy. He was very, very impressed with Richard Ebeling. So if you like Bob Murphy, Bob is but the student. Okay, Richard here is the teacher. You've stayed in contact with Bob over the years. I've seen you at an event that Bob held a number of years ago.
Absolutely. And I have to assure the listeners that hearing that Bob said all those things, that means I owe him probably an envelope full of $5 bills for some of the nice things about me.
Well, we'll discuss that off the air, of course. So I want to talk about some, like, for example, the public goods question. A lot of times when the subject of free markets comes up, particularly on social media, you'll get people who took Economics 101. And they'll say, oh, you market fundamentalists, don't you know that your own textbooks tell you that the market can't do everything and that there are things called public goods and there are things called externalities and therefore we need... And it's very unimaginative because there are many cases in which we have found that particular examples of public goods are not actually valid or the argument undergirding public goods may have some flaws. They are unaware of any of this. They just memorized the Economics 101 textbook. How would you complicate the question for people like that when it comes to the subject of public goods?
Well, I think that to begin with, it's important to define what a public good is. Now, the way traditionally the mainstream of the economics profession did so and has continued to do so since the middle decades of the 20th century is that a public good is something that can be supplied to everybody from a central source such as the government, but it's very difficult to exclude any who have not paid for it. The classic example, and I know you know this, Tom, is usually considered national defense. Let's suppose that I'm a visitor from Europe in the United States, and just as a visitor, other than maybe a sales tax on my hotel room, I really don't pay American taxes, including what would be considered that portion that covers the budget for national defense. But I can't be excluded from the defense umbrella of the Air Force, the missile system, et cetera, that envelops the entire continental United States. They can't leave a little hole open and say, well, Pierre here visiting from France has not paid any American defense taxes. So if there's an attack while he's visiting, it can go right down the hole and hit him. So that's the standard example of that. Then they try to extend that to a whole variety of things that I consider illegitimate. Roads, thoroughfares, public spaces such as rivers and lakes that supposedly need to be cared for in some common fashion. Schooling, which is a stretch in making this case. The two things are a problem here. And if I'll start with the latter ones, all of the instances that are extended for this, such as roads, highways, bridges, lakes, rivers, all of these historically have had times when they were private enterprises with private property in which individuals can be excluded who do not pay for services rendered and therefore do not defray the cost of the person who has an incentive to attempt to market them. But there's the additional problem that even if we take the national defense example, the fundamental problem here, and I mentioned this in one of the chapters in my book, is you end up with the problem that the Austrians, and particularly Ludwig von Mises, emphasized with economic calculation. Where there is no market, there's no buying and selling. Where there's no buying and selling, there's no exchanges of higgling and haggling between the demander and producer. If there's no higgling and haggling, there's no agreed upon terms of price. And if there's no agreed upon terms of price, then we know neither what consumers want or the value they place upon it, or the value of the resources that could go into manufacturing them in that particular purpose, as opposed to serving some other end that consumers might want to have satisfied instead. So we are left in the situation that with, yes, government can, you could say government has this responsibility for national defense. And I understand that in classical liberal and libertarian circles is the whole debate of limited government versus market solutions, even for these. But I'm trying to argue just, well, if you believe that government has to do this, you have an insoluble problem. How do you know what is the right amount of national defense? There's no price mechanism. The government collects its revenues through compulsory taxation. I don't go through a menu and say, well, I want this type of missile system. I might support this type of foreign intervention, but not this one. I believe that this is the type of military bases that should be set up around the country, supposedly to ward off attacks, but not others. We're left totally in the dark, the same way the central planners in the Soviet Union were in this situation in trying to decide how many hats, how many shoes, how many paper clips to make, because there were no markets. And as Mises called it, it leads to irrational planned chaos. And if I can just extend this in one more example, Tom, let's take this Department of Homeland Security that emerged out of the 9/11 attacks on the Trade Towers and the Pentagon, and now almost 20 years ago. There's this argument that we need to have these protections against terrorism. Now, how do we know this? How do we know when terrorism has been solved? When do we know that too much is being spent on fighting terrorism? I'm taking the presumption that there are these threats just for the sake of the argument, that there's too little, that there's too much, that this is the type of surveillance that should be done to quote, by some objective standard. We don't. The same way the central planners in the Soviet Union had no answers to this. So as a result of this, there's no way of knowing, is it the wrong kind of protection? Is it the wrong amount of protection? Has the problem been solved and we can downsize the protection? Because there's no markets for people as citizens to decide, well, I think that there's this degree of a threat, but not that. And as a private individual, this is what I'd be willing to pay for. The same way we do now. We hire security services. For example, in my house, I have a security system. I have sensors. I have locks. I have cameras in my house with the concern that, you know, if you travel in another family member's home or you're away, all members of the family are away, that you. So I pay a price. Now, was there a premium super duper version I could pay for on a monthly basis? Yes, Tom. But, you know, do I really need the super duper given my other budgetary constraints and other things I'd like to spend my money on? We each make these choices ourselves. But once the government takes over this monopoly responsibility, whether it be defense or roads or bridges or rivers and lakes, you end up with this problem. So we have to understand that, A, many of these things can be factually, historically, and logically shown to have market solutions. And if you believe that there are a certain number of core functions, such as defense or police, that need these government provisions, we have this irreconcilable problem that we have to operate with total economic irrationality of not knowing how much we need, what types, and where. And therefore, we have a planned chaos with these core elements of defending people's lives and society.
You said in bringing up education that it seems dubious to apply the public goods model to it, but some people try. And I think they try because they're just using the term public good in a colloquial sense rather than in a technical economic sense. They just mean that it confers a public benefit. I don't think they're thinking about non-excludability and non-rivalrousness and stuff like that. So we'll leave aside whether education qualifies as a public good. What I'd like to talk about is you do have a chapter in your book on education and on free market education. And I would say that this is probably one of the toughest sells a classical liberal or libertarian has, because people cannot imagine how you could provide education in a way that would be inexpensive enough for everybody to have it. So, I mean, is there a pithy response to that concern?
Yes. The pithy response is that there are many things that are socially valuable and useful to many of us, or even in some sense, all of us, which the market provides. Food, for instance. Education is valuable, but I think we would all agree that without food, all of us would have a serious problem. But we don't expect the government to fund or finance or provide food. We understand that if we create the right incentives, individuals in our system of division of labor will find motivations and profit gains from becoming farmers and developing the farming technologies in such a way, guided by market opportunities, to make more food available in greater varieties and through technological innovations to lower the cost of the provision of food, such as that at the beginning of the 20th century, a little over 100 years ago, approximately 50% of the U.S. labor force was involved directly or indirectly in farming. Today, it's less than 3%. And we have such an abundance of food that we not only feed all of ourselves in the United States, but have an immense amount of food that we export. That is when Donald Trump is not trying to interfere with this, with his trade wars, but we feed a large amount of the people around the world. Now, all of this has been done through the market incentives. Now, education is valuable. We all desire it, certainly for ourselves, but even more so for our children. What better way to assure this than if we set loose the opportunity for individuals to decide what kind of education are parents and young people looking for? The content, the curriculum, the teaching styles to make the subjects interesting and attractive to hold the student's attention and to want to learn. That is certainly not the case today. And we all know there are good schools and there are bad schools in the current public educational system, Tom. So would there be a spectrum of different types of schools in a private sector system of education? Certainly. But at each step or range of these different and varying schools, each one would have the same market-based incentives. How can I attract more student customers and their parents' tuition dollars by making it better, less expensive, more attractive, and useful when they go out into the real world? Now, if I can just continue with this slightly longer, Tom, with your permission.
Of course.
There's an historical basis of this. As I'm sure you know, that there was this now unfortunately deceased Canadian economist named Edwin West, E.G. West. And he wrote a book called Education and the State a good number of years ago, in which he demonstrated that before government mandated schools between approximately 1790 and 1830, 2/3 to 3/4 of the entire British population was made literate. This is during the period of the Industrial Revolution, when compared to today, people working long hours, tiring hours in the emerging factory system. But 2/3 to 3/4 of the entire British population was made literate in a matter of a few decades through church education, for-profit schools, and other type of secular charitable educational establishments around Great Britain. This is an immense example of these achievements. And even today, we see the success of private education, with even though that we are already compelled to pay for our public school system through the taxes we pay, sales taxes, property taxes, depending upon where you're living in the United States, people, even with those tax burdens, choose to then incur the additional double tuition of when they can afford it to send their children to private schools. And those schools prosper. They offer better qualities. Now, if we look at the quality of those existing private schools that have to operate with a competitor who can offer things, quote, for free because you're compelled to pay for them, we can imagine what the world would be like if we just had an entire spectrum of private schools improving the qualities, the varieties, the teaching techniques, the curriculums to be attuned to what young people need to know in general, just to be enlightened human beings, as well as to prepare themselves for their adult lives. The same way we've come to take it for granted that food grows in abundance of vast varieties and qualities, and increasingly at lower prices if you compare how much you spend out of your budget today compared to our ancestors, let's say 100 years ago.
All right, I've got a couple of tough questions coming up, but first, a word from our sponsor. Well, I guess it's safe to say that the most memorable line I've come up with in support of any of the sponsors of the Tom Woods Show is calling myself King of the Airport with my Away carry-on. It's lightweight, so it's easy to carry up and down stairs. It's durable, so it can take a beating. The built-in compression pad helps you pack more in. Your wheels won't get stuck because these four 360-degree spinner wheels must be the smoothest things I've ever seen. Plus so many other benefits besides. And if anything ever happens to your luggage, they'll fix or replace it. I myself have two Away carry-ons, and I've bought two or three as gifts for others because they are such a perfect gift. Plus they give you a 100-day trial that lets you try any Away product on the road. So what have you got to lose? And because you're a friend of Woods, I'll give you a special deal. For $20 off a suitcase, visit awaytravel.com/woods and use promo code Woods during checkout. That's $20 off a suitcase when you visit awaytravel.com/woods and use promo code Woods during checkout. Let me skip ahead to the end of the story, if I may, just because I've got this question on my mind and I'm not really sure I have, frankly, a satisfying answer to it. You know, you're trying to make the case for a new liberalism, and it reminds me of Mises' book, Liberalism. And there's a passage in there that I won't reproduce quite right, but it's something along the lines of that the state parties, the parties whose programs are centered around state solutions and state activity, they have songs and flags and slogans. What we have is reason. And what we are doing is appealing to the rationality of the general public. No, we don't have the patriotic songs and the flags and the slogans. What we have is reason. Now, there's something very, very attractive about that. That's certainly the side of things I want to be on, is the side of reason. But at the same time, Richard, there is a part of us, I think, that has to be honest enough to recognize that a lot of average people don't sit around saying, I wish I had a good book that could reason me into what my political views could be. They get swept up by the songs and the flags and the slogans. How can we compete with that?
I think that we should use our reason. And here you're talking about tactics or strategies, not just the logical content of an argument. I think that we have to attempt to try to formulate and present our case about these various sides and facets of liberty the way our classical liberal ancestors did in the late 18th and through a good part of the 19th century. Let us think of the issues that face them for a moment, Tom. We often forget that the end to human slavery is only about 200 years. Through all of recorded human history, it was taken for granted that slavery was an inherent part of the human condition. Some were masters and some were slaves. Aristotle said that some were naturally born into these two categories. Well, you're going to disagree with Aristotle? Yes, there were a few dreamers who imagined that, you know, wouldn't it be wonderful to have a world in which all people were free and were treated the same and were not burdened with the threat of the whip? But this was pie in the sky by a handful of dreamers and philosophers. But then in the 1700s, the 18th century, there emerged an anti-slavery movement, in many ways guided by a deep religious faith. And that is, in Great Britain, men were guided by their religious conscience to ask the question, how can we justify that some men hold others in human bondage to lord over others when there is only one Lord in heaven of whom we are all his children? How arrogant, how presumptuous it is for some to play God in this sense, to demand obedience like a god over other human beings with the threat of force. Now, they began to make arguments, particularly in the 19th century, about the economic inefficiencies of slavery, the loss of incentives, quote, the more logical argument, which as an economist, I consider to be absolutely valid and true. But they also couched this in the human dimension. And that human dimension is that they told their fellow British citizens, and then as the idea spread to the United States, what was it like for human beings to be seized and captured and transported across the Atlantic in conditions that we can't even imagine, which people would describe who had become abolitionists, who had somehow been involved in the trade, slave trade, who had been on the slaving ships, what it meant to be a slave on the plantations, whether in America or in Brazil or in other places where the institution was prevailing. And they combined the reason that is it not logical that all men should stand with the same rights before the law, that everyone should have a certain political as well as economic standing of liberty, with the idea of explaining how hard, what a hardship was, what cruelty is involved, what inhumanity is involved, and how it perverts the human psyche in either being a slave or the master. And therefore, they touch people's senses of right, of justice, and combining that with the argument of reason to overcome this. Now, you might say, well, slavery, of course, you know, everybody can, or many people could understand the emotional discovery of how can you justify that. But there were also economic arguments. Let me use one other example, if I may, Tom. And that was the abolition of economic trade protectionism in Great Britain in the middle decades of the 19th century. Britain had a thing called the Corn Laws. This was basically agricultural protection. So the landed aristocracy in Great Britain could be protected from lower priced foods that otherwise might have come into Great Britain from foreign suppliers. Now, the free traders, the Anti-Corn Law League, as it was called, whose leaders included Richard Cobden, John Bright, They presented the logical arguments, you know, the benefits of division of labor across borders, comparative advantage, people to specialize in what they're relatively best at. And if others can provide cheaper food than we could do at home, then let's specialize in something we can do better than them. And we're mutually all better off in terms of the price and the quantities of what we could have. We all prosper. Trade is a positive sum game, not a zero sum game. But then something happened, and this aroused people's emotions that piggybacked on the argument for the logic. And that is, in 1845, 1846 was the worst rains in human memory. The crops were destroyed in both Britain and in Ireland. People were facing mass starvation. Young children who had learned to write because of those private schools would write graffiti on the walls of buildings. I be protected and I be starved. Seeing the hardship and the consequences of a policy that was so inhuman to allow people to have access to cheaper bread resulted in, through a series of votes and then an act of parliament in June of 1846, bringing about by one fell swoop, unilaterally, the end of virtually all the trade protections in Great Britain. Britain became a free trade country virtually immediately, certainly in agriculture and very rapidly in most industrial products, because of combining the logic of the power of why free markets and freedom of exchange and a division of labor make all men prosperous in the context of understanding the hardships, the harm to the human condition when some are used political privilege to benefit at the expense of all the others or many others in the society. So we need to develop those arguments to explain the human side of it. You know, newspapers love to have like the human interest story. Well, let us remind people of the human interest element when the state intervenes, when the state regulates, when the state redistributes, when the state protects, when the state subsidizes, when the state prohibits and denies people the liberty and the opportunity to freely associate with their fellows for their mutual benefit and have equality before the law rather than privileges and favors to some at the expense of all the others.
Before I let you go, that was about as good an answer as I could have asked for. There's a question that doesn't come directly from your book, but it's very much in keeping with the theme of the book. And it's one that I see a lot of people implicitly asking who are socialists or democratic socialists. And they'll say, you talk about your so-called free market, but this is an objection that goes back, you know, over 100 years. Really, you're just free to starve. How am I free if I have to sign on with an employer somewhere? Otherwise, I'll starve. I mean, in what sense is this lopsided relationship a free one? He holds all the cards, and I'm the helpless person who, without this job, would be destitute.
Well, I think let me sort of put it in this context. Let us suppose that you're alone, like Robinson Crusoe, on your desert island, and you merely have your mind, the strength of your body, and whatever implements you may find to use for various production purposes to stay alive. Who's obligated to see that you have food on your table? The fact is, at the end of the day, it is only through human labor that consumption is possible. There are no entitlements alone on an island other than your own creativity, ingenuity, and applying your physical strength to the resources that by accident you find around you. In society, we benefit from this. Again, if I can allude to the Robinson Crusoe story, when does Crusoe have the emergence of opportunities? When Friday, that native shows on the island. Now, at first, Crusoe tries to enslave Friday, but his Christian conscience finally works on him, and he lets Friday go. And as they stop having these fears and angers and hesitations about each other, they start slowly trading. And each of them is made better off by trading what they are able to do that the other cannot or in less time, so that both have a higher standard of living than if they lived in isolation. Now, in a system of division of labor, we know there's the butcher and there's the baker and the candlestick maker. And whichever particular line that we specialize in, we buy what we need from others. Now, there's a more intensive division of labor, and that is the fact that some people have either through accumulated savings in the past or having shown the acumen of being a successful businessman as well in the past and earned significant profits, that is, revenues above his cost of production, to have the means to hire others to help him produce goods and services. If that individual, if the entrepreneur, the enterpriser, the businessman did not have the financial wherewithal to advance wages, to pay people salaries during the production processes until a product is ready to sell and revenues may be earned because the workers get their agreed upon salaries. The entrepreneur is hiring them on his best guess that he can guide them in a joint effort to make products a consumer want that consumers will actually buy and pay a price to cover those expenses that he's incurred paying us our salaries. So in fact, we are better off of not having to be Robinson Crusoe, not having to wait until the season ends to have the harvest to live off, because others, through their accumulated savings and profits, have the wherewithal to pay us so we don't have those inconveniences and hardships. We mutually gain. The businessman has someone who can assist him in producing so he may earn a profit in the future, and the worker who doesn't want to burden himself with entrepreneurial and business tasks, either he doesn't want to wait or he doesn't feel he has the skills, so he can receive the means of his livelihood by participating in production while another bears the burden of the risk of his hire. Now I'm really making an argument here, Tom, which goes back to the Austrian economist, particularly a famous Austrian economist who was Ludwig von Mises' teacher, Eugen von Bumbaberg, a famous Austrian economist on the theory of capital and interest, a professor at the University of Vienna, at whose feet Mises studied himself. That the whole understanding of production and division of labor is inseparable from time, and that we who work for salaries are benefiting from others who have the financial wherewithal to advance us the wages until the product is ready to be sold, and he may or may not earn a profit or even recoup the cost that he's incurred, enabling us not to have to bear those entrepreneurial risks.
By the way, how is it? Do you like being at the Citadel?
Yes. Two things. The listener's not familiar. The Citadel is technically called the Military College of South Carolina. Now, it is not the West Point of South Carolina. It was before the Civil War, but now it is basically a four-year liberal arts-oriented college that also has some graduate programs like an MBA. But the students are very self-selecting in that they're looking for the structure, the focused attention and discipline that a more military ambiance will help them assure that they'll get the education that they want and will finish with their diploma. So they're attentive, they're interested. And if I can put it this way, Tom, we talk about the left dominating much of academia today. Well, at the Citadel, the Student GOP Club has 400 members. The Student Libertarian Club has 150 members. The Young Democrats have 35 members and a faculty advisor.
Wow, that's interesting.
So it's a different political culture. And let me say one other thing. Oh, it's a military college. They must all be gung-ho for foreign interventions and war and killing people. Au contraire, many of the faculty, I'm in the School of Business teaching economics, have been in the military as officers and pursued business degrees and now are professors. If they have fought wars or been logistically involved in these foreign wars, they're not excited about sending young men into new wars. And the young students, the more enlightened conservatives, and certainly the libertarians, are very savvy to understand that these wars serve purposes having very little to do with the legitimate sense of national defense, that is, protecting people's lives and properties from a real foreign aggression.
Well, that's very interesting to hear. Of course, our friend David R. Henderson taught for a long time at the Naval Postgraduate School out in the West Coast, and he didn't have any problem being somebody who was pretty open about his views on foreign intervention. So that's I'm actually pleased to hear that. So your book is For a New Liberalism. That's what we've been discussing today. I've got a link to it up at tomwoods.com/1528, another excellent product of the American Institute for Economic Research. So, Richard Ebling, thanks so much for your time.
It was my pleasure. Thanks for having me on.
All right, folks, that's it for today. Now, we, of course, are in the middle of the primary season for the Democrats. I suppose the Republicans are also having a primary season, but a more competitive one going on among the Democrats. And I think it's important to realize that although there are a whole bunch of really bad candidates among the Democrats, I think in the long run, I think Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez, because of the way she's generated so much media attention, is the longer run threat, really, because a lot of these candidates are going to be forgotten pretty much the next day after they drop out. But I think and I fear she has staying power, which is why in 2016, I did an ebook called Bernie Sanders is Wrong that I have over at BernieIsWrong.com. But this time I didn't do one on a presidential candidate. Instead, I did one on AOC called AOC is Wrong, going through all her pet issues and giving you the kinds of arguments that just demolish them. So if you haven't picked that up yet, please go do that. It's at AOCIsWrong.com. Doesn't cost you anything. AOCIsWrong.com. And I think it'll help you build up that arsenal of replies. All right. Lou Rockwell tomorrow for his new book. We'll see you then.
Become a smarter libertarian in just 30 minutes a day. Visit TomWoods.com to subscribe to the show for free, and we'll see you next time.
Like the sound of the Tom Woods Show? My audio production is provided by Podsworth Media. Check them out at podsworth.com.